Good morning, everybody. I'd like to go ahead and call Senate Finance Committee to order February 27th, 2023. The time is 9:02 a.m. With me today is Co-Chair Hoffman, Senator Bishop, Senator Wilson, Senator Merrick, Senator Keel, myself, Stedman. We have two work items on the agenda today. First up, we're going to have a consideration of the governor's nominee, Commissioner of Revenue, Mr. Adam Crum. And then we're going to follow that up with a presentation on Medicaid enrollment and spending forecasts, which is one of our factors we have to deal with as we look forward over the next several years on our budget. So with that, I'd like to go ahead and ask Mr. Crum, come forward. He's a nominee for the Commissioner of Revenue. Thank you for your willingness to volunteer. I don't know if your boss asked you to volunteer for this position or not, but thank you for putting your hat in the ring on this one. I'd like you to go ahead and introduce yourself for the record. Go ahead and touch on your educational background and your work history, and then your understanding roughly of the position of Commissioner of Revenue. And we have been joined by Senator Olson. Mr. Crum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Adam Crum, Commissioner Designee for the Department of Revenue. Thank you to the committee for having me here today. I'd like to give you a brief history of my background, education, work history, and my vision for the Department of Revenue. I was born and raised in Alaska, one of five siblings. Growing up in a cabin in the small town of Anchor Point, allowed for a life of outdoors, fishing, camping, hiking, and hunting. I graduated from Homer High School as a valedictorian and earned a scholarship to play football at Northwestern University. I graduated with a bachelor's degree in psychology with a focus in pre-med. After college, I returned home to Alaska and started working at my family company as a safety professional and trainer on projects around the state. This allowed me to travel and see all regions of Alaska with extensive time in the villages across the North Slope. To further my career, I pursued an advanced degree from Johns Hopkins University, graduating with a Master's of Science in Public Health. My diverse educational and professional background allowed me to work as a consultant and project lead for large oil and gas companies, pipeline companies, and transportation companies. Some of the work performed include contract negotiations, organizational development, leadership development, and risk management. Almost a decade ago, my siblings and I purchased the family company and have grown it to include a commercial construction company and many commercial real estate holdings. Being an entrepreneur with a diverse portfolio provides a lot of very real experience with banking, real estate investments, and corporate finance. You have to learn in a hurry all the nuances of procurement, grants, corporate governance, and all the other aspects of running businesses. From this background, I've been able to develop organizational and strategic expertise, putting together a history of developing high-performing teams and a positive culture. I was able to bring these skills to bear 4 years ago when Governor Dunleavy appointed me as Commissioner for the Department of Health and Social Services, or DHSS, the largest department by positions and by budget. Suffice to say, my tenure at HESS was not routine. Less than a month into the role, we were notified by federal partners that the Alaska Psychiatric Institute, or API, was at risk of losing its authority and license to operate as a hospital. So we took immediate measures by bringing in management consultants to stabilize the situation. We were granted leave to continue operating, and with focused efforts from API staff and management, they've been able to grow their census count to levels not seen in years and have multiple successful site surveys by accrediting organizations. Then in early 2020, we were hit with a global pandemic. The next 2.5 years of all of our lives were wrapped up in dealing with COVID-19 and its after effects. Items such as supply chain disruption, the Great Resignation, long COVID, rampant inflation, and economic turmoil. Looking back on the pandemic, I am beyond proud of how Alaska responded as a state and as a people. From its inception, Governor Dunleavy stressed partnership and clear communication. And I feel like we were successful. You gauge how Alaska fared in relation to other states in a multitude of health statistics. The level of responsibility that fell to the health department was unprecedented, and we took our role seriously. Examples being CARES funding. This was sent to states with very little guidance from the Treasury. But we were deliberate and labored to create a defensible fair program, partnering with many community groups such as the Alaska Community Foundation, to help pay out $50 million in relief to nonprofits across all sectors. Funds were used for direct hospital and clinic relief, to purchase testing equipment and personal protective equipment, to pay for modified operations at state agencies. In just over a year, we disbursed $500 million in CARES relief funding. We also set up an airport testing program that was first in the world and stood up in just over a week, with the goal to ensure safety to Alaskans while supporting our tourism economy across the state. We also worked to have cruise ships return in 2021. This was a coordinated effort with our federal delegation to get temporary federal law change to allow cruise ships to come to Alaska, and then a focused effort from the health department as well as our state emergency management team to develop safety plans, communicate with local communities, and negotiate with international cruise lines on responsibilities. In the midst of this was an earnest and robust effort to reorganize the Department of Health and Social Services so it could work on system redesigns to better serve Alaskans. It took two executive orders and one full year of extensive, exhaustive stakeholder outreach, but in July 2022, we were successful in splitting DHSS into two departments, Department of Health and the Department of Family and Community Services. This was the largest organizational structure change for state government in almost 40 years. The primary purpose of this was to have a narrower focus and span of control so systemic issues can be addressed and programs revamped for better service delivery. All of this leads to where I am now, Commissioner Designee for the Department of Revenue. The department has had quite a bit of change at the commissioner position for the past 6 years. This culminated this past fall when Governor Dunleavy was going to be without a named revenue commissioner one day after the November election. He didn't wish to name another interim that would only be there till the end of the term in December. He wanted this critical department to have stability and leadership, and he wanted someone that could step in on short notice and succeed. Based upon our level of trust and my track record, the governor offered me the position. What I bring to this role is stability and managerial expertise. I also bring credibility, both with the public and, I hope, with the legislature. I bring an aptitude and adeptness, the ability to rapidly learn and employ knowledge. I've demonstrated the capacity to learn the necessary skills of any role in order to hire the right personnel and put them in position to succeed. This is evident by statewide awards presented to me by the Alaska Chamber of Commerce and Commonwealth North in 2021. These awards are a recognition of the responsive, hardworking organization I was able to build at Health. The Department of Revenue plays a critical role in our state by taking the primary role in collecting of taxes and revenue that help fund state government, investing billions of state funds, and determining eligibility and administering the permanent fund dividend, while also enforcing and managing child support. The department is lucky to have a lot of experienced, dedicated staff that are very good at their jobs. Treasury Division has a long-tenured, well-respected director and a high-performing chief investment officer. The Division of Tax has experienced, brilliant staff that administer our complex programs. The list goes on. It's my job to support and enable these teams to perform at the highest level possible for Alaskans. In the role of commissioner, I am the fiduciary of nearly $9 billion. This is a legal requirement to manage the funds for the benefits of all Alaskans. This entails regular investment review and risk meetings with our qualified staff, advisors, and consultants, and sharing this info with the public and the legislature. Also in this role, I sit on the boards of the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation, the Alaska Industrial Development Export Authority, the Alaska Municipal Bondmake Authority, the Alaska Retirement Management Board, and as a trustee for the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation. Combined, these groups manage and invest over $100 billion. My vision for the department is to have a renewed focus on economic development. Governor Dunleavy has made this a key focus of his second term and has instructed all of the executive branch to work together on diversifying our economic base and finding ways to bring more people into Alaska. My goal is to use my position as Commissioner of Revenue to work on this by supporting local community economic development, by sharing the knowledge and resources we have at Revenue, and by building relationships and connecting with investment banks, financial firms, credit rating agencies, and industry leaders to sell the story of Alaska. I continue to serve because I love and believe in this state. I want my daughter and all Alaskans to have opportunities to thrive and enjoy this amazing place well into the future. And with that, that's the end of my presentation, Mr. Chair. Open and glad to take any questions. And
we have questions from anybody here at the table. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner Crum, or Commissioner Designee Crum, I guess I look at your resume and your educational experience There's a lot of difference between being the Commissioner of Health and Social Services, which at that time was and now has been split up, but being the Commissioner of Revenue is a whole different ballgame, and I could see why you were chosen for, because of your history of being there with the School of Public Health. But why would you, I guess my question is, why would you want to be taking on a role such as this when right now we're dealing with budget deficits and those kind of things that would make life a lot less fulfilling, because we essentially don't have any money for the state? Fill me in on that and why you think that you want to take on this position.
Through the chair, to Co-Chair Olson, I appreciate the question, sir. And really, it's I have the heart of a serpent. I have opportunities elsewhere, but I want to continue to see Alaska put in the best position to succeed over time. I've been able to show that can respond day in and day out over the long term to very complex situations by putting in the best team. And seeing that Alaska is in a precarious situation where we're at with our budget over time, where we're looking at for a long-term forecast, I wanted to do what I can to help enable to work with our partners here in the legislature, to work with industry, to work with the public and other communities, to find ways to get Alaska to succeed for the long term. I want to stay in Alaska. I want my kids, my nieces, my nephews to do that. This is one of the reasons why I'm trying to step up in this role, sir.
Well, Mr. Chairman, the most critical question I think that's on everybody's mind when it comes to looks at revenue is what the permanent fund dividend is going to be doing and what's going to be the amount of it, because that's what everybody wants to and is a part of that is eligible for it. I guess if you think down the track, what do you see in 5 years if you have got the vision for something like that they can rest their anxiety on?
Through the chair, Senator, or Co-Chair Olson, I appreciate that again. You know, as my role as trustee of the Permanent Fund Corp, one of my jobs is to make sure that the health of the fund is maintained over time. And so the legislature took great steps towards that by setting in statute the POMV draw. One of the things that in conversations that we've had with credit rating agencies over the last couple of months is the overall year in and year out aspect of dealing with what is the dividend going to be, how much is going to be available to state government versus checks out the door. While I don't have a say or can predict what the amount will be, what I can say is it has been offered in credit rating agencies that a predictable, stable amount, meaning that it's just if there is a statutory fix to determine that would actually help our credit ratings over time. It can help bring a focus to the state of Alaska when it looks to long-term investment, that this is not going to be an item of hanging, how are we going to fund government over time?
Last question, Mr. Chairman, has to do with the constitutionalization of the permanent fund dividend. Are you in favor of that?
Through the chair to Co-Chair Olson, yeah, there's an outstanding board resolution from the trustees upon which I support about putting the POMV into the Constitution as well as combining the funds.
No further questions, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner Designee Crum, thanks for being here today. First question I have for you is sort of a general theory of our investments question on some of these investment funds we're using to pay for specific programs. The one we've discussed most at the table has been the PCE fund with the tremendous losses it suffered this last year. Higher education fund, same deal. We've got a couple of others. Broad strokes, your beliefs. Are we in the right investments for our goals, and do we have the right goals for those funds?
Through the chair to Senator Keel, thank you for that question. It's an interesting aspect when you look at asset allocation for investment funds. When you look at and how you compare is based upon the benchmark set upon each of those funds. As are we in the right asset classes? That is a question of concern, right? We have to make sure, are we doing this correctly? So there's a process which has been in place at the Department of a long time, but it was kind of memorialized, so to speak, that a couple years ago by we post these online. Yes, we have met with our active consultants doing our both asset allocations and our risk tolerance for these different fund sources. Within Treasury, of those funds, about the $9 billion that I mentioned, a lot of them have very different risk profiles. A lot of them probably should be looked at. Some of them will be high in the cash and low on the risk because they're long-term horizon. Other ones can have higher risk side, like the PCE and higher education. As far as where that sits at, we look to the legislature on that as well to help provide guidance. when we're looking at, is that the correct aspect? It's more about how we manage those funds, and it's the pacing of the investment of those funds. If you look over time, the Treasury Department, the Treasury Division at the Department of Revenue has done a very good job beating the benchmarks upon their key performance measures. So they do a good job on the active management side. And so I think we're just going to have continue. I've appreciated the meetings we've had with the committee, with other legislators on, like, what are the proper profile? Because the world as a whole is very much changing at this point in time. When we look at what is the economic outlook, what's going to happen to inflation, is the Fed going to raise basis points again? How do we address this? And so it's about the pacing aspects. I think that from a performance standpoint, we've done well. Right? We didn't lose as much as we could have compared to other groups. But the long-term use of those funds is a consideration that I think the legislature needs to engage in. We'd like to be part of that conversation with you.
Follow up.
Thank you very much. And I appreciate the openness to conversation. Are you able to share with the committee what general direction you're pushing? Stand pat, more risk, less risk?
Through the chair, Senator Teal, not changing the risk profile at this point in time. That's not a part of our overall conversation. Is actually staying where we're at as we try to gauge what's going on. You know, with inflation the way it is and with basis points going, this is, makes fixed income a little bit more like bond returns is going up. But how do you do that on a long-term basis? It definitely changes. You also don't want to exit a market when it's at a low point. So it's about determining where we're at and are we going to anticipate our historic returns going to come back. And so at this point in time, part of what the reviews we've gotten from our consultants is actually just holding course.
Thank you.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Commissioner Designee. The governor submitted a budget to the legislature that is looking at carbon to balance the budget, but that is a long-term solution and will not be materialized before the end of this fiscal year. We have close to $500 million in deficits. How do you see us as a state moving forward, providing the services that you alluded to for Alaskans? And one additional sub-note is that the governor did not include an additional $30 million for community assistance. What are your views on assisting communities to be healthy by the state of Alaska?
Thank you. Through the chair to co-chair Hoffman. Assisting communities is a critical aspect. There's a lot of different programs that the state of Alaska does that on. As far as which direct program, that is an item, again, that it comes up with the legislature as well because they hit different areas. There are different concerns for which group, which region gets those funds. When we look at the budget that was put forward, it does require us to dip into our savings a little bit as we do that. That's part of the discussion I've appreciated with this committee over the last couple of months as we look at what is the best path for Alaska going forward. I think a fiscal plan overall is a very key aspect for the state because it will bring stability when we look at it from a credit rating standpoint. We do have nice prospects on the horizon both with the future carbon offsets or carbon credit market as well as some of the oil and gas plays. And using this as a window of time to bring, look, Alaska can be stable as we talk to our financial partners, but also how do we bring more into the state? That's part of what our primary concern is, what we're reaching out for.
Follow up.
You talk about looking at our savings to balance this year's budget. That topic has received a lot of attention at this committee, but the main savings that could be utilized would be the Constitutional Budget Reserve Account. You're probably aware that it requires a very, very high standard of three-quarters vote, and unless you have a plan to get the three-quarters vote, I believe the majority, if not all of this committee, feel that that is an impossible ask. So if it is an impossible ask, where would you look at as additionally to find $500 million to $750 million to balance this year's budget?
Through the chair to co-chair Hoffman, Yes, the CBR is a very, very high threshold. As you know, there is no existing CBR vote for FY23, and so we're going to have to be very diligent in our cash management to make sure that we have enough funds throughout the remainder of this year going forward. When you look at the FY24 budget with the proposed deficit and dipping into the savings, that is a complex question on how we do this. This is an item to either we have to cut or make adjustments to the budget, because in the real term, any program that is put into place may not collect enough revenue in that short time frame to cover the gap.
Just follow up, and then we'll
one follow up, I guess. Then you do not support looking at additional revenue measures to balance the state's budget?
Through the chair to co-chair Hoffman. No, I think it's a part of discussion we have to have in our long-term fiscal plan. If there are additional fiscal measures the legislature wants to put forward, I know we've got separate questions from different legislators that we are running down and providing information on what that would look like. And so that's part of what the job is at the Department of Revenue, is to use our economic research group to provide as objective numbers as possible. If X, then Y. What do these numbers and the input look like as we do our forecasts? And so it's a conversation we want to help provide our numbers based on that, compare those to Lynch Finance as we have these discussions going forward.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. Commissioner Daisy Crum, welcome today, and thank you for your service and your former capacity helping us all through that pandemic. One of the reasons you took this job and answered the call, we heard that, but specifically is to grow the economic development in the state by the governor's action. You know, he asked you that, right? So we know from 2012 to 2022, the GDP has went into the basement. We know for the last 10 years, we've lost 8,800 people a year in the state. So can you just give me a vision, your top one, two, and three ideas that you're working with the administration to grow the economy?
Through the chair to Senator Bishop, I appreciate that. One of the unique aspects about Alaska is you look at our economy. We have both an out-migration and a relatively weak economy, but yet we have some of the highest average or median home costs. And so what we need to do in order to actually encourage folks to come here is concurrent paths. We need both economic opportunity and development. We also need housing. This includes both inventory and access to housing across the board. This is in all communities of the state. So this is an item that working with multiple departments, both DNR, Department of Environmental Conservation, Alaska Housing Finance Corporation, upon which I sit on the board, as well as with local communities and different landowners, on what are the prospects that we can do, either from an economic incentive side, from a local level, how do we work on that? How do we put together deals that actually encourage developers to put forward multifamily housing aspects so we can actually get affordable housing for Alaskans to move into and people to come into the state? As well as housing's a big deal. We also have to talk about our child care and our education side as well. How do we bring stability to that? I know that's a robust conversation in the legislature, making sure that we are seen as a good educational development state moving forward. So those are some of the key things that we're working on across the administration, is these concurrent paths. How do we bring these forward to get people into Alaska seeing a hopeful, positive outlook for our state?
Thank you.
Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, I appreciated meeting with you, Commissioner Designee, late last week, and we shared some frank exchange about the past job. So I think it's fair to say that when you were Commodore of the whole armada that was Health and Soc, you helped and your team fought off some real attackers, some real threats. At the same time, one of the supply vessels is sinking. And we're trying a floater, but it's foundering. So as folks call my office concerned that we give you a new command, what do I tell them?
Yeah, through the chair to Senator Keel. One of the unique aspects about running such a large department as Department of Health and Social Services is even in the best of times, you are constantly triaging issues. There are, as we say, three or four or five burning issues at any one time. And you're dealing with vulnerable Alaskans who are asking for help. And it is difficult to respond from a leadership standpoint to all of those items at the exact same time. On top of that, over the last couple of years, we had both the pandemic and a cyber attack, which weakened our systems. We also had, along with that, federal relief dollars numbering in the billions, creating new programs across the board. And so this was an item that we looked at to make sure both protect Alaskans, help make sure that our state agencies and our other government functions, because we had to help provide them safety plans and other tools in order to actually continue their operation, that we're working across the board while getting new programs and new funds out the door. This is an item that we see as an issue going ahead. There's always going to be these burning items that are left over, but part of the benefit of the executive order to reorganize the department into two is to really highlight the gaps in services. These are items or things that may have been lingering for a generation or more that need to be corrected, and this actually allows the time and space for leadership to dive into and do firm corrections so we are responding to Alaskans the best way possible, that we don't have lingering issues that just have to wait until we can get to it, that we can handle them more up front.
Other questions for the commissioner? Just got a brief comment. One of the challenges that we always face is to have accurate and the best information brought forward by the departments, and that both bodies in the legislature use those numerics as we go through our budgetary process. So we don't end up with the finance committee having our set of consultants and expectations. The other body has theirs and the administration have theirs. And I think the integrity of the revenue commissioner is important. Sometimes your boss may give you instructions that mathematically don't add up. And when you present those things to the finance committee, it doesn't go well. So it's got to pass the red face test, and your math has to work. Yes, sir. And the earlier question that Senator Hoffman brought up, the roughly half a billion or larger, because we haven't got done with it, budget deficit, we don't have the cash position to survive but a couple of years under those scenarios. And I think he's on point that it's unlikely that there's going to be a three-quarter vote. And it's unlikely that the administration is going to bring us budget reductions to close the gap. All of the amendments I've seen so far have been increases. So we're going to have to work together over the next couple of months to ensure that this administration could at least cash flow the state to the end of its term. And that is a concern. Just got a quick question for you on that. I'd like to know what your opinion is on the cash balance that the state should have to ensure the ability of the state to make payroll and to actually function.
Mr. Chair, thank you for that. The cash management is an item since earlier in the session that we've been wanting to pay attention to because we don't have the outstanding CBR vote for the FY23. So this is an item we just got an actual review on this last year or this last week about an update. It's about every 2 weeks we're finding where's our position at, how are we holding, when are we going to do our secondary draw from the earnings reserve based upon the remainder of the POMV. So this is an item that we want to make sure at this point we feel like we are in a position to last FY23 throughout, but throughout the rest of the term we've got some other concerns on how we are going to do this. This is going to be conversations we're going to have to continue to work together on as we continue to pursue.
And the minimum cash balance target for the CBR that you're comfortable as a target?
Mr. Chair, to echo what OMB Director Neil Steininger put forward, you know, the optimals is, you know, $2 billion is nice to make sure we've got flexibility to do what we need to do and make sure our government operations are sustained.
Right, and for those watching at home, we have about 2.3 is the target. So, and the state takes about $400 million just to cash flow. So, we don't have a lot of room. Is the point? So, with that, Mr. Crum, I wish you luck in your endeavor in working with the finance committee. Please don't bring us expectations of an oil price and expect us to put the state in peril of over $1 billion in deficit. Last your predecessor did that. It didn't go well. We have to make sure we physically manage the state's finances so we don't put the whole state in peril or the permanent fund. That's Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that the Senate Finance Committee forward the name of Adam Crum as Commissioner of the Department of Revenue to a joint session of the legislature as delineated by Article 3, Section 25 of Alaska's Constitution. This does not reflect any intent by any member of the Senate Finance Committee to vote for or against the confirmation during this until further session.
Do we have any objection? Seeing none, the committee designee will move forward. And thank you, Mr. Crum. I think you're going to be a good addition to the Department of Revenue. And I'm serious when I say that. I think that you're going to help the department and with the relationship with the legislature also.
Thank you, sir. Thank you, committee.
Next up, Medicaid enrollment and spending forecasts. We can have a couple of folks come forward. The Vice President of Evergreen Economics, Ted Velvoort, you're going to have to help me pronounce your name. Okay. You can hop in the chair and introduce yourself for the record, who you represent, and then you have a presentation for us?
I do.
Okay. And what we'll do here, we'll let you complete a slide before we ask a question and just pause for a brief second or just check with me. I'll flag you if there's a question. If not, we'll just keep rolling through. And we'll try to be done in an hour and a half.
All right. Thank you. So through the chair, for the record, my name is Ted Helvoit. I'm Vice President of Evergreen Economics and here to talk about the long-term Medicaid forecast. If you could advance the slide, please.
Thank you. Sure. Go to page two. There we go.
All right. So the genesis, if you will, of the long-term forecast starts with the Alaska legislature. And between 1998, fiscal year 1998 and 2004, Alaska's population did grow slowly, 1.3% per year. At that time, Medicaid program was growing at 6.5% per year. So growing relatively fast. Most of that growth was due to the Denali Kid Care. So the states.
Can you please pull your mic in?
Oh, sure.
And speak into the mic so it booms in so we can get proper recording.
Right. Is that better?
Yes.
All right. Yeah. So my apologies. Start that over. So the long-term forecast began with the legislature in 2005. And at that point, just a few years before that, from fiscal year 1998 to 2004, Alaska's population grew about 1.3% per year. But enrollment in the program was growing much faster, 6.5% per year, but mostly children through the SCHIP program, Denali Kid Care. Over that same period, Medicaid spending was growing by 18% per year and almost tripled between fiscal year 1998 and 2004. And so, and most of that growth was due to increases, not increases in enrollment, rather increases in spending per enrollee or spending per recipient. And so the legislature allocated funding and directed the Department of Health and Social Services at that time to solicit proposals from qualified firms to do a long-term study of Alaska's long-term prospects for Medicaid enrollment and spending. And so that first presentation or the first forecast was completed in 2006, presented to the legislature. And so that background is important for my presentation. We're going to focus on what came out of that first long-term forecast and what what's going to, essentially is on the Department of Health's agenda now for the next 20 years. And that gets to bending the cost curve, Medicaid cost curve. So next slide, slide three. And actually, let's go right to slide four. So I have a set of three slides that gives a historical and prospective look at Medicaid spending in Alaska. So the first slide looks at the total spending on the Medicaid program. And then we're going to follow up with two more slides that look very similar with respect to colors. So The red line represents actual spending on Medicaid. The blue dotted line represents that first forecast from 2006, and the green dashed line represents the current forecast. And as you can see, essentially immediately after that first forecast, spending growth flattened. So flattened for a little while, then started growing much slower. And so that when we get out to fiscal year 2022, so the last full fiscal year, spending is just over $1 billion less than we originally forecasted. We expect spending to increase over time, over the next 20 years, but again, at a slower rate than we originally projected. So next slide, to slide five. So the former slide was spending. This one looks at recipients of Medicaid, and just for a couple of definitions, and many of you are probably familiar with this, but a Medicaid enrollee and Medicaid recipient are two different things. So a Medicaid enrollee is anyone who's enrolled in Medicaid, and a Medicaid recipient is an enrollee who's actually using services. And so when I talk about recipients or talk about enrollees, I'm looking at an annual unduplicated count. So we can look at these as the typical ways to think about enrollment are annual unduplicated count, monthly average through a year, because there's a lot of churn, month-to-month churn, or for a particular month. So for all the forecasting purposes and what we talk about today, it's going to be focusing on that annual unduplicated count. And I'm going to focus, although I'll mention enrollees a few times, I'm going to focus on recipients because that's what matters in this program, not enrollees, and you'll see why. As the graph shows, so the red, again, is the actual number of recipients on the Medicaid program. The blue dot is the blue dotted line is the original forecast, and the green is the current forecast. So this graph shows that the actual number of recipients tracked very closely to the forecast from 2006 until fiscal year 2016 with the beginning of Medicaid expansion. Well, this began September of 2015, so that's fiscal year 2016. Spending increased quite a bit, and the number of recipients in the program increased quite a bit. That was essentially coincided with a pretty substantial recession in Alaska and then into COVID. So next slide. So slide six. So the first slide showed spending was much less than we expected. The second slide showed that there's far more recipients than we expected. So the only way when we look at spending per recipient, the only thing that can happen would be that spending per recipient is quite honestly extraordinarily less than we expected. And so these three slides are important because it demonstrates the amount to which the department and legislature have worked to bend the Medicaid cost curve. And so the red line of the actual over the last 10 years, the amount spent per Medicaid recipient has barely moved. And in the future, it's going to increase some, but it's going to increase at a much slower rate than that original forecast. All right, so we're going to switch gears for just a moment to look at some recent trends and events, but that topic or that discussion of bending the cost curve, we're going to come back to, because that the way the Medicaid cost curve has been bent in the past is going to be tougher to continue doing. There's a lot more challenges to the there's going to be challenges to the program going in the future, but there's also some ways to address that. So recent trends. The most obvious recent trend is COVID, and this graph shows for fiscal years 2020 through 2022. The blue line at the beginning of at the far left of the slide shows the trend in enrollment before the COVID emergency announcement. And then with the continuous enrollment requirement from the feds, enrollment increased precipitously. So you can see that's that red line with a very different slope in growth of that time period. And so enrollment in the program increased a lot under that continuous enrollment requirement. This is a recent trend, but this is really as far as the long-term Medicaid forecast, this is relatively unimportant. those are, that's going to come back down, and it's going to be back into trend in a few years. So moving on to slide number 9, shows monthly spending over that period of time. And you can see that the spending decreased very quickly with the start of the pandemic. And this would be a combination of individuals wishing to stay away or choosing to stay away from medical care because of COVID, the fears of COVID, as well as many services that were not emergency being postponed by medical providers. And so that spending decreased, but then has started coming back. So it's back on trend. And what's important, it's back on the trend of what we're seeing before, despite the increase in enrollment in the Medicaid program. So let's move to slide 10. Take a little bit of a detour here to look at the state's performance under COVID. And so the first bullet deals with the state overall. Then the second two bullets are kind of focus on the Medicaid program. So in state overall, in comparison to peer states, and for this analysis, the peer states include Montana, Wyoming, North Dakota, South Dakota, Idaho, and New Mexico. So I get it. There's not a truly peer state to Alaska with respect to size and population, but those are about as close as you're going to get. So in comparison to those six states, and after adjusting for differences in age across those states, so the distribution of people across ages, Alaska experienced 20% fewer deaths, excuse me, 20% fewer hospitalizations between the beginning of the pandemic through the end of January. And so that's about 3,300 fewer hospitalizations in the state. That's beyond Medicaid. That's just overall hospitalizations in the state, and experienced 22% fewer deaths. So nearly 400 fewer people died in Alaska than would have based on looking at those peer states. And I don't have the data up there, but it's the same story when you look at in comparison to the U.S. overall. So, after adjusting for age differences and such, that Alaska performed very well through COVID. The second bullet and third bullet focuses on the Medicaid program in particular, and in comparison to what we would have expected had the state performed like the peer states. Spending was about $31 million less over that nearly three-year period, and the state general fund spending was about $5.6 million less. And finally, the last bullet focuses on long COVID or post-COVID symptoms or syndromes or conditions, and this is looking for 2021 and 2022, and that's when there was actually a diagnosis code for that you could actually identify in the data post-COVID. The state has spent on the Medicaid program about $4.6 million on treating post-COVID symptoms and conditions, and a little less than $1 million in state general fund spending. This is going to continue in the future. I don't think it's going to be a sizable part of the Medicaid program, though, in spending. All right, then finally, with respect to some of the background and such and kind of historical perspective, this graph shows spending and enrollment and recipients over the 2012 to 2022 period. The bars represent total spending on the Medicaid program, and the blue in the bar represents the state general fund spending, and the red represents federal spending. And so that's general fund spending and designated. So any state funding, in fact, with the blue bars. Between 2012 and 2022, the spending by the state on Medicaid program has barely moved at all. And so it increased a little bit, but with the additional allocation from the feds, the 6.2 percentage point allocation from the feds, spending that the state's spending on the Medicaid program in 2022 is about exactly what it was in 2012. Of course, the federal spending has increased quite a bit over that period of time. And so those are the bars and represent on the left-hand axis. The green line represents enrollees in the Medicaid program, so the annual unduplicated count of enrollees over that period of time, and the blue line represents the number of recipients each year. In 2012, 88% of Medicaid enrollees were recipients also. So in 2012, 12% of the people that were enrolled in Medicaid at any time did not use any services that year. By 2022, that increased to that decreased to 74%. So that in 2022, this last year, 74% of all Medicaid enrollees used services, 26% did not. So essentially, in the program as it exists today, one in four Medicaid enrollees are not using Medicaid services.
Complete this slide.
And that would be it. Yeah, that's it for that slide.
Olson?
I think, Mr. Chair, just wondering, are these normal dollars or are they inflated for adjustment?
Great question. Through the chair, these are nominal dollars. These are actual dollars. So if we adjust it by inflation, by just say general price inflation, it would look even better.
So, Senator Bishop, then we'll go to Senator Keel. You're done? Yeah. Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Hovoy, thanks for the presentation. Can you talk to us at all, do we have a sense of why that divergence in enrollees versus recipients in the last time period here, decade?
Through the chair, good question. I think the best individuals to address that would be with the Division of Public Assistance. So that would be providing the review eligibility. I would give two reasons why part of this partially happened. So part of the ACA, the MAGA requirements of ACA, moved from the very frequent, the possibility of a state doing very frequent eligibility checking of enrollees into one that moved to 6 months and into a year even, so that the amount of churn of Medicaid enrollees has dropped over that period of time. And so if we went back to 2000 or 2004 or such, we'd be like 95% of all Medicaid enrollees were recipients. And so that part of that MAGA requirement was from the ACA was that the enrollment is not looked at quite as often. And so people do not fall off the rolls like they used to. The other reason for sure would be that the continuous enrollment requirement of the federal government with respect to the COVID pandemic. And so my assumption, and I'm sure this shared by others, would be that there are many people enrolled in the Medicaid program that don't know they're enrolled in the Medicaid program. Or they may know they're still enrolled in the Medicaid program or think they might still be enrolled in the Medicaid program, but they moved onto a new job and they have insurance through there, or they're getting medical care on their, just out of pocket. So it's, I think there's a number of reasons, but it's definitely the case. There's a big separation, a growing separation between the number of enrollees and recipients in the program. So,
Lynn, could you maybe help us with the percent of the population here? You've got the total population that are enrolled and recipients, but it'd be nice to have that historical chart and the percent of our population.
Yeah, so in 2022, the percent of the population that was enrolled at any time in fiscal year 2022. So, again, with enrollment, a person is included as an unduplicated count, an annual unduplicated count, if they're enrolled all 12 months or just 1 month. So, and again, even with the continuous enrollment requirement, there is still churn in the program. People still do leave the program because they move or whatever. But about 37% of Alaskans were enrolled in the Medicaid program at some time during fiscal year 2022.
What was that percentage?
37%. 37%, yes.
Okay. Senator Wilson.
Yeah, just to follow up on Senator Keel's question, Mr. Chair, just wondering, we understand 2016, 2017 is when the expansion happened, but then the department allowed Medicaid enrollment specialists into various healthcare clinics and hospitals. And just wondering if the lack of access would also include the divergence in this number, and especially with Medicaid enrollment specialists involved in, I think, every major hospital and community health center around the state. But will the re-enrollment process now, the two-year lag of not being able to do that, will that divergence start to come back down? Would be interesting. Just
just a comment.
Next slide.
All right, so let's, we're going to switch gears and look at the projection. And in this look, I don't provide a whole lot of slides on the projection per se. We're going to focus on two different parts of that projection that are really important to the Medicaid program going forward and important to the state going forward. And that was was talked about when Commissioner Designate Crum was up here earlier. The first one is population. And so Alaska's population is going to grow very slowly over the next 20 years. And this is straight from the state demographer, Alaska state demographer. The population is expected to grow at about 0.15% per year through 2043. And over that period of time, the number of children are expected to actually decrease in Alaska by about 0.3% per year. And the largest part of the population that's going to be growing is the 65 plus part of the population. And it's no great secret that in general, children are really relatively inexpensive on Medicaid. Working age, so adults 20 to 64 are more expensive. And then the most expensive groups tend to be seniors. And so it's going to be a big challenge to the program moving forward. It's a big challenge to the state moving forward. So that's one issue that's really important in the forecast. The other one is that I want to address in here is the issue of.
I'll stop there for a second. Back up to 13.
Yeah.
So you're showing here is that correct? A growth in population of roughly about 0.83%, 1% per year, average annual change if you add up the far right columns.
No, through the chair, if you could repeat the question, please. Yeah.
I guess I'm trying to tie in you're talking about here the average change in the age groups. Mm-hmm. And I'm looking at your 23 population of 736,000 and 28, 744,500, but we're going backwards in population. So the trend is in the opposite direction of what you're showing here.
Through the chair, this is straight from the state demographer. So, the population has decreased the last few years. The expectation from the state demographer is there's going to be a slight increase between 2023 and 2028. So,
okay.
All right, so moving from population to essentially medical price inflation. The Medicaid program per se is not impacted by medical price inflation. Medical price inflation affects the direct consumer through insurance premiums and through out-of-pocket payments to providers and through deductibles to providers. The Medicaid program prices or the cost of Medicaid increases based on reimbursement rates that are negotiated between the department and providers. I looked at a relatively short historical look at the difference in medical price inflation. So what would be from the all urban Alaska CPI component for medical services versus the reimbursement rate over that same period of time. And so between and these are year over year changes. So 2016 to 2017, the medical price inflation increased much faster than reimbursement rates did for Medicaid. The same with 2017 to 2018, 2018 to 2019, and 2019 to 2020. So over that period of time, medical price inflation in Alaska increased 3.6% per year faster than Medicaid reimbursement rates. In the last two fiscal years, fiscal year 2020 to 2021, and then from fiscal year 2021 to 2022, medical price inflation increased slightly faster than in 2021 to 2022 by about a point faster as I guess you call it a little bit of a catch up on that divergence between the rate of growth in medical price inflation versus the rate of growth in Medicaid reimbursement rates.
Next slide. You got a question, Senator Wilson? Don't be shy.
All the time, Mr. Chair. Could you talk a little bit more about our peer states and how we compare to our peer states in these rates and growth? My understanding is that Alaska is one of four states where our Medicaid rates are actually higher than our Medicare rates, and just wondering how our other peer states have seen this growth and trend. And then I have a follow-up after that, Mr. Chair.
Yeah. Through the chair, I do not know on that question. I don't that's something that I could look into and provide it to folks in the department to get back to you, but I don't know that. Answer that.
And just also wondering, you know, we talk about these rates, reimbursement rates are growing higher, but is there any studies that you've looked at that actually has the cost of care in Alaska comparative to our other states of what their cost of care is compared to our cost of care?
Through the chair, great question. So the cost of care in Alaska is much more expensive, for sure. There's no two ways about it. And with I think it's really important to note in this, when we think about medical price inflation, again, medical price inflation is what the consumer is paying. So the individual with the premiums you pay for insurance, with the co-pays, with deductibles, versus Medicaid reimbursement rates. They're different, but they're related in the sense that providers need to get paid. And as reimbursement rates for Medicaid are held down, and we can see from the bend in the cost curve, the state has done an amazing job at holding costs down on a per service basis, on a per individual basis. There is I won't say well documented, but there's definitely an impact on the private sector from that. So as if the to keep on providing services to Medicaid recipients, there's the likelihood that providers have to raise prices on where they can, and that would be on the private insurance side of things. And so that medical price inflation in Alaska is growing a little faster than the rest of the country. And so, again, and that medical price inflation is what's affecting essentially the private sector, the individual getting services, that out-of-pocket service cost.
Just one more follow-up, Mr. Chair. Then on that issue then, how does our medical tourism play effect? I mean, every major insurance company, even our Alaska Care, participates in medical tourism, where it's just cheaper to fly someone out of state. How does that play a part into our price and inflation and Medicaid reimbursement rates flying up?
Through the chair, Senator, so it wouldn't affect except to the extent that the medical tourism was with Medicaid recipients. So, and that would be, those are embedded right into the cost of the Medicaid reimbursement rate. So if the Medicaid program is moving people out of state for services, then I would see that cost independent of who provided that service. I would look at it as the actual service. And so, to the extent that that happens, that is right in the rates there. With respect to individuals or insurance companies that would move people, out of state for services, it would not show up in the CPI, essentially the CPI component of that would show up in another state. It is based on the state the services happens. And so, and it would be this exact reason why insurance companies and others would do that. So.
Okay, next slide, please.
Right, so through slide 15. So this slide simply shows my assumptions or my forecast for where medical price inflation is going to go over the next 20 years versus Medicaid reimbursement rates. And so the medical reimbursement rates, I'm unfortunately been pretty right on these forecasts, and it's going to continue to increase quite a bit. The Medicaid reimbursement rates, this is essentially an assumption. My assumption being that the little bit of growth that we've had in the last couple of years is not going to continue. But it's going to have to grow to some extent. And so this is essentially, you could think of it as from the state's budget perspective, a relatively nice forecast or conservative forecast of reimbursement rates for Medicaid. They're going to have to increase over time. Providers, we want to keep providers. But that goal then, of course, is to not increase them too much. All right, so bottom line. So the actual spending on Medicaid program, between 2023 and 2043, it's going to double between that period of time. And that is a long period of time. And the assumption, or my estimate is, it's going to increase by about 3.6% per year, which doubles it after 20 years. For the state, the increase is going to be greater than for the federal government, 4.2% on an average annual basis for the state versus 3.3% for the federal government. And that is almost 100% due to the undoing of the 6.2 percentage point enhanced FMAP over the next couple of days, FFP or FMAP, over next couple of years. And so this that's going to move pretty quickly. And then at that point, the growth will be about the same for the state and for the federal government.
Senator Wilson.
Just the FMAP, the enhanced FMAP, that was never going to be a permanent solution. So why would states plan that to put that in their base of their funding allocation for Medicaid programs? I just have a problem struggling with that concept.
Through the chair, Senator, I don't know that the states obviously have enjoyed it having that, but I don't know that they assumed it as a funding source. So, you know, FMAPs do change at times, and, you know, for the better and for the worse, I guess, from the state perspective. So, yeah.
Okay. Senator Teal.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess this slide on growth and total spending is a good opportunity to sort of look back at the last couple. At what point, as you said, we run the risk as we hold our rates down of losing providers. At what point does that flip on us, and do we start to see so many fewer providers that our costs rise? And how do you calculate that in here?
Yeah, through the chair, that's actually an interesting question, and that's not something I've ever looked at before. That would be something that is analytically doable, to look at the number of providers within different service categories to see has that increased or decreased over time, held steady. And so that's actually I think it'd be a worthwhile thing to look at. And there'd be some other, I'm sure there is research that has been done that has looked at that, so that to kind of understand what's the implications if you start losing providers in different segments of the, you know, the medical or the healthcare overall. So.
That's good. Thank you.
Okay. Next slide.
So moving to slide 17, and this is my prettiest slide, I believe, or most colorful slide. So the blue bar at the bottom represents spending as it is today, and assume that the number of recipients today and their demographics and their spending stays constant over time. And so that's that, just the baseline spending that's going to occur into the future. Then each of those lines above there represents a different component of growth in the Medicaid program. There's a very thin gray line above there, and that represents the very slim amount of population growth to the state over the next 20 years. The green right above there is increase in enrollment. So enrollment rates have increased over time, and that's going to continue to happen in the future, most likely. And again, this is the about the forecast. It's guided by the past, and it's under the assumption that there isn't going to be some type of great change in the future. Although obviously these things do hit, you know, the ACA, Medicaid expansion, the pandemic and such. So long term, so the assumption that the enrollment rate is going to increase over time. The brown represents the utilization of Medicaid services. So utilization in this case refers to it's a kind of a compound effect of that over time, individual and Medicaid use more and more services. And so if we go back to that very historical data, back in, let's say, fiscal year 1998, the typical Medicaid recipient was using 2.6 different service categories per year. And this is across 20 different service categories, so such as inpatient hospital, outpatient hospital, behavioral health services, and such. Today, they're using about 3.4 services per individual, and that's going to continue to increase. A lot of that is due to the aging of the Medicaid population. Adults use more service categories than children do. So that's the utilization part of it. The light blue above there is increase in the intensity of Medicaid or medical use or Medicaid use of the services. And so this is the case of, and this is from an economist. So the used to be someone got a an X-ray, now they get an MRI. So that'd be a case of the intensity of the service has increased over time. Or they're, in the past, a person did not get physical therapy, now they get physical therapy. So those are kind of types of intensity of Medicaid services. And then finally, the light red or mauve color is the increase in the growth in the reimbursement rates for Medicaid services. And you see that is where most of the growth is over the next 20 years. Keep in mind that picture from a couple slides before of the difference between my forecast for Medicaid reimbursement rates versus medical price inflation. And so if the Medicaid budget or Medicaid spending was directly tied to medical price inflation, we'd be talking about a tripling of costs between 2023 and 2043. All right, so we're going to switch gears here to chronic conditions in the Medicaid program. And again, I'd like to tie this back to that original where we started out with bending the cost curve, the issues of the difficulty in bending the cost curve. And a big part of this is the chronic conditions. So let's start with, an economist's definition about chronic conditions. And before talking about chronic conditions, let's talk about acute condition. An acute condition is a condition that occurs pretty quickly, comes on suddenly. You break a bone in your foot, or you get the flu, something like that, would be an acute condition. Chronic conditions typically occur over time, gradually, and then persist for many months or many years. And they can be due to, and this is, again, there's probably broader number of categories, but lifestyle choices or lifestyle or socioeconomic type environment. So drug and alcohol abuse, obesity, tobacco use, environmental. Certain cancers in asthma would be related to environmental factors. And then there's congenital disorders also. So something such like a cystic fibrosis or Down syndrome. So chronic conditions is a wide swath of different conditions. And it's important to think about these in modifiable and non-modifiable chronic conditions. And for the Medicaid report, I don't actually do that. That's something that was recommended to me by the department to look at that in the future. So to consider those chronic conditions that are modifiable versus those that are non-modifiable. Okay, so first the good news. So of in fiscal year 2022, of the roughly 201,000 Medicaid recipients, the vast majority did not have a diagnosed chronic condition. In 2022, my estimate is 51,000 people had a diagnosed chronic condition. And I think it's important to note how I come up with a chronic condition or designate someone as having a diagnosed chronic condition, because there's not a clear way of doing that. So there's a little bit arbitrary. So within Medicaid claims data are diagnosis codes. And so diagnosis codes, and there's thousands and thousands, there's tens of thousands of diagnosis codes. And among those diagnosis codes are ones that specifically are for different chronic conditions, heart disease, cancer, diabetes, whatever it might be. Within that Medicaid management system, so within those claim data, there are columns for up to, I believe, 12 different diagnosis codes for each claim, and there's over 6 million claims in 2022. And so I designate someone as having a particular chronic condition, and there's 54 chronic conditions through CMS that I then aggregate down to 24 just for simplicity, but I designate someone as having that chronic condition if they have at least 2 diagnoses of that chronic condition and their spending is at least $5,000 during the fiscal year. And that is consistent with what other researchers have done, but not exactly the same as all other researchers. But it's fairly conservative in this respect, in that I have a both, I have to see that diagnosis go twice for that particular condition, and it has to be, there has to be real spending. As you might imagine, children are much less likely to have a chronic condition, a diagnosed chronic condition, as adults. And in this figure, on slide 20, for those under 25, relatively few children have chronic conditions. As we get to older and older age categories, the proportion of recipients with a chronic condition increases. All right, so moving to slide 21. And so this looks at that, at the distribution by age is a little bit differently. And so instead of showing the number of individuals, it's simply the percent. And so for children under five, all the way up to seniors 85 and over, the proportion of the Medicaid population with one or more diagnosed chronic condition increases all the way up. And there is that drop at 65 to 74, and it starts increasing at 75 to 84. This is due to two reasons. So first off, many Medicaid recipients lose their eligibility for Medicaid when they turn 65. So for instance, anyone who is enrolled through expansion would transition to out of Medicaid and onto Medicare at 65. And then also many people who still maintain Medicaid eligibility at 65 or older become duly eligible for Medicare. And Medicare is the number one payer. Medicaid is the secondary payer. And so it appears, because I only see Medicaid data, it appears that people are either getting very healthy when they turn 65 or something else is happening. And it's just something else. There's many people have left the system, have left Medicaid, or they're getting those, they're being treated through the Medicare program.
Here we have a question from Senator Wilson. Okay, Senator Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just two questions. First, are we making the assumption here that our general Medicaid population are aging through the system? So someone that's 15 and under would age properly up to without waving in and out, or are we assuming that these are new beneficiaries? Do you have that?
Yeah, through the chair, Senator, good question. This is a snapshot. This is a snapshot for fiscal year 2022. So this is exactly who's in the system at that time. And it's a great question in that all the modeling I do not assume someone who's in Medicaid is going to necessarily stay in Medicaid. Each individual has these different characteristics. They have a gender, they have an age, they have a region of the state that they live in, and then they have different chronic conditions or they have spending in different areas. And those are important, but that individual per se is not held in the system.
Just as a follow-up. Then because it appears that in your previous slide that, you know, the people that are under the age of 24 it makes up the majority of Medicaid, but it seems that the chronic conditions happen after that age. Going on to your next slide, and just wondering, are we missing something in our Medicaid services that would catch and probably could reduce some of these chronic conditions as they age higher than 24? Because it looks like, you know, we have an opportunity to do something from the age of 24 under, but it's the 24 and older that seems to have more of the chronic condition. Just wondering if there's did we miss something in terms of an opportunity to lower that chronic condition rate?
Yeah, through the chair, Senator, I think that is an absolute great point. The last part of this presentation, we're going to talk about Healthy Alaskans 2030, which the department asked me to look at and see how it could integrate into the long-term forecast. It's definitely the case that, so two things that we're going to see a couple slides forward. So two things are true. Number one is an individual, their propensity or their likelihood to get diagnosed with a chronic condition, and then a second, a third, and fourth chronic condition increases with age. And there's a whole number of reasons for that. Partly is our choices, lifestyle choices. Partly is you're around longer. You have more chance to hurt yourself or to transmit some type of disease. So it's definitely the case the number of chronic conditions the person has been diagnosed with increasing over time. But it's also true that being older doesn't mean you're more expensive. What matters is, do you have that diagnosed chronic condition or not? And so there, I think there's absolutely opportunities to reduce spending in the Medicaid program. And again, this is from an economist. I don't know how you do it, but there seemingly, just logically speaking, there would be ways to reduce long-term spending on an individual and increase an individual's quality of life by different type of interactions that would reduce either reduce the likelihood of developing a chronic condition or reducing it, eliminating it sooner. And there's some obvious ones, smoking, drug and alcohol abuse. Those are obvious ones. And I'm not saying they're easy ones, but those are obvious ones right there.
And then for the prevalence of chronic care conditions, have you looked at our peer states in terms of the peer states that have managed care organizations and see if that's a lower rate compared to the states that may not have managed care organizations in Medicaid? And again, I think there's only a handful, and Alaska is one of those states that we do not have a managed care organization.
Yeah, through the chair, Senator, amazingly, other states don't look at their data very well. So I would challenge you to find great data being published or information published on Medicaid population in any of these states. So there are academic studies that look at a particular population, either rarely for a whole state, but in a smaller area. And part of the challenge is the fact that most states are not doing a pay for service, and so that information is not housed with the state necessarily. It's housed with that individual care coordination company. That's just to say that this information is not widely available across state by state by state. There are national data and on chronic conditions and such, but again, there's definitional issues that differ with respect to what we're doing here. So.
Okay. Next slide.
Okay. So I mentioned before that, so it's true that the likelihood of being diagnosed with a chronic condition increases with age. The likelihood of being diagnosed with a second or third or fourth chronic condition increases with age. And so on slide 22, this table, I'll kind of lay it out for you, I think hopefully clearly. So divided into five columns. So column A, B, C, D, and E. The first column shows 12 different age categories. These are age categories that I used throughout the forecast. Column B shows the average spending for recipients in that age group. So again, not enrollees, recipients, so individuals who are actually using services. As you look at this, you can see, well, obviously, as people age, spending becomes greater and greater on those individuals. And then we move to column C, though. And column C looks at recipients on the Medicaid program, those 150,000 Medicaid recipients who have no diagnosed chronic condition. And except for the youngest age group, under five, and the oldest age group, 85 and over, there's essentially no difference in the average spending per recipient. So once you account for the chronic condition, age does not matter, essentially, is what I'm pointing out. We move to column D. When we look at just those diagnosed with one or more chronic conditions, we see that the highest spending is in the 85 and older category, most likely because they have multiple chronic conditions and they're likely in a nursing home. Many are in a nursing home. For the youngest, also some high spending. But between the children 5 to 9 through 55 to 64 age group, virtually no difference in that average spending. So it's definitely the issue of it isn't age that's driving spending, it's chronic conditions that are driving spending. Of course, the likelihood of being diagnosed with a chronic condition does increase with age.
Okay. Next slide.
All right, so slide 23. This is the same forecast we looked at many slides ago, showing the 3.6% growth in spending over time. And this slide simply says, okay, of that spending, how much of it is going to be on those with chronic conditions? How much is going to be on those without chronic conditions? In 2022, 77% of spending was on individuals with one or more diagnosed chronic conditions, based on my definitions. By 2043, that's going to be 82%. So it's going to increase over time. And that 82% should be viewed as lower bound. The only thing that's I allow to affect this forecast when looking at the difference in spending for those with chronic conditions versus those without is how the population of the Medicaid population is going to age over time. And so to the extent that individuals are more likely to be diagnosed with chronic conditions in the future through any number of reasons, this could be even higher than this. But it definitely should be viewed as essentially a lower bound on spending in the future. All right, so last part that I want to talk about is the Healthy Alaskans 2030, and something I have no involvement with at all. I was just asked to consider what was being done in Healthy Alaskans and to try to inform, in the report, use the long-term forecast to try to inform what are potential impacts that could, positive impacts that could be for the Medicaid program associated with Healthy Alaskans. And so this is, again, going back to that bending the cost curve. The chronic conditions are driving the cost curve up. Healthy Alaskans has the potential to push that cost curve back down. So I'm going to actually read a little bit through here. So Healthy Alaskans 2030 is the state's health improvement plan and provides an approach for how the state can improve on the most significant health issues that Alaskans face. And again, not something I was involved with at all. Among the 30 health objectives that the Healthy Alaskans looks at are seven that are related to reducing cancer mortality, increasing the percentage of children that are of healthy weight, so reducing obesity within children, reducing mental health issues for adults, reducing drug and alcohol abuse for both adolescents and adults, and then finally reducing tobacco use among adults and children, adults and adolescents. And this is these are these seven that directly tie to chronic conditions I look at in the long-term forecast.
Hey, Senator Wilson.
Yeah, I don't know if you're finished with this slide, 26.
We can talk about it, certainly. Oh, okay, I'm not, but you want to talk about?
Yes. Yeah. Mr. Chair, I have been involved in Healthy Alaskans 2020 and now 2030. And, you know, the last three bullets here, I think the national trends, even the trends in Alaska, show since COVID, these have gone up. Mm-hmm. And just wondering how come, you know, you're saying that this would be the decrease, but the current trends are it's actually increasing. And just wondering how come that's just not related in the slide.
Through the chair. And my apologies, I should have been a little clear on this. These are the objectives. So this is not the trend in what's actually happening. These are based on the objectives of Healthy Alaskans 2030. This is what would have to happen on an average annual basis to reach that objective by 2030. And so, which is very different than, as you mentioned, with mental health, very different from what's actually happened with, especially with COVID.
So let's have them go through the slide before we ask the questions on the slide, please. You can go through page 26.
Yes. So through the chair, Evergreen Economics looked at linked those seven different goals from Healthy Alaskans to particular chronic conditions, and specifically cancer, obesity, mental health conditions, drug and alcohol dependency, and tobacco use. And you can see in there the decrease in prevalence that I assumed for this analysis, this part of the analysis. And again, this does not go into the forecast at all. This is simply using the forecast to say what could happen if if we are able to reduce the prevalence of these diseases. Made that assumption that Healthy Alaskans would translate into a reduction in the prevalence of cancer over the next 20 years at a relatively strong clip of 0.88% per year, of obesity at a 0.44% per year, and on through the last of those. And again, not saying that's going to happen, but what would be the impact if that did happen? Oh, went a little too far. So,
are you done with the slide? Slide 26?
Yeah. Yes.
Senator Wilson, you have a question on slide 26.
He answered it. Just this is what could happen, but the trends in the 3, 4, and 5, Mr. Chair, have been quite the opposite.
Okay. Going to page 27, please.
All right. So last slide for the presentation, and this is then linking those Healthy Alaskan 2030 goals to chronic conditions. and then looking at what would be the potential savings to the program if the prevalence of those chronic conditions were reduced, and looking at, so the first column shows which of those Healthy Alaskan objectives, second column is the chronic condition that it affects, and then potential impacts in fiscal year 28, 33, 2038, and 2043. And so the bottom line is, and this is a relatively simple example, but if prevalence of those chronic conditions did decrease at the rates shown in the previous slide, it could translate into savings of over $400 million per year, and over about $120 million per year for the state.
Senator Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, it's interesting, you know, this past year or a couple of years, the state has been sort of pushing this Healthy Alaskans 2030, you know, goals initiatives. It's a group, a collaborative group of many stakeholders, the state, 18AC, many other state partners. But, you know, we haven't funded any of these initiatives into action. It's just more of a data collection and what ifs. I'm just wondering, is the state going to actually come to the table with actionable items to address these issues?
I think that's the policy call for the committee here, if we want to add things to the already increasing deficit. Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A question about the two biggest dollar categories here. They're also very broad categories of Medicaid billing codes, right? Mental health can be everything from an occasional counseling appointment to hospitalization.
Right.
Can you just give a sense of did you just apply the savings uniformly across the category, or did you look at the elements of those Healthy Alaskans goals and extrapolate which services they might save us the most on?
Through the chair, Senator, good question. So you're right. So for taking mental health especially, that it's there are many different service categories. I focused only on those that are viewed as being a chronic condition. And so there would be many mental health diagnoses that are not viewed as being chronic. These would be only those chronic conditions in doing that. And so and it isn't linked to the individual. It's linked indirectly to each of those different diagnoses, the different procedures that were received by those with those diagnoses, but it should be linked to the individuals that were diagnosed with those chronic conditions. And mental health is one that I'm actually glad you pulled out. That is a critical one. The mental health spending has grown over time, but beyond that, those with a diagnosed chronic condition of a mental health issue, their spending on acute care is far outpaces other Medicaid recipients. So their spending goes far beyond behavioral health. They're the ones that are often at the emergency room. They're the ones that are receiving services in many different areas. And so they're, in a lot of ways, they're kind of a special concerns, particular ones within the chronic mental health space. So.
Follow up?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So I guess just to bore down a little more on your estimated potential impacts here on saving spending, are these spending reductions or reductions the result of fewer people getting to chronic condition, or lower acuity, less hospitalization, fewer ER visits? How did we get to $220 million by 43?
Right. Through the chair, Senator, it would be through reductions in the prevalence of the number of individuals diagnosed with a chronic condition, with a mental health chronic conditions, or any of those other ones also. So it isn't the reduction in acuity, although it could be essentially the same thing. In fact, you could look at this either way of saying, like I looked at it as reduce the prevalence of the individual chronic condition, but you could just as well say it reduced the acuity of that chronic condition and get to the same place either way. And that the spending impacts go beyond that individual chronic condition. And so within the modeling and stuff I do, there's expectation of what would be the average spending on different acute services that an individual would consume through year after year after year. And that differs for someone that has a mental health diagnosis. Chronic condition diagnosis. And so this includes not simply behavioral health spending, but also reductions in other areas of the Medicaid program, so other services for ambulatory care and such.
Senator Wilson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. This is, I guess, eye-opening for, you know, for the administration to take a look at. We've passed bills in this building that have not been, the regs have not been written for 6 years, that in testimony with the department's own actuary said that it would reduce costs by $50 million a year, and yet the regs still have not been written, or they're sitting in Lieutenant Governor's office to be signed. And it would be helpful now, knowing this data, to show those impacts of those bills and to finalize those pieces of regulations would be cost beneficial to the state of Alaskans and to help increase access for Alaskans as well.
Any final questions for the presenter today before we conclude? Okay, thank you for coming to the Finance Committee and presenting this information. We'll be working on the subject as we go forward, as Senator Wilson said. Do you have any final comments?
I do not. Thank you very much.
Okay, so that concludes today. Wednesday will be our next meeting. That's Wednesday, 9 a.m. We're going to hear from the Alaska Municipal League post-COVID updates on our municipalities. So we are adjourned at 10:33 a.m. We are adjourned.